Greetings and welcome to DWR, Discussions on Writing and Rhetoric, a space for informal conversations around research and practice in the field at the university level. A place inclusive for curious novices, blossoming scholars, and seasoned academics to consider and share their inquiries, experiences, and passions surrounding writing and rhetoric. We are your hosts, Professors Megan Falconer and Nicholas Gardiakos with the University of Central Florida. Thank you for joining us. Now let's get this conversation started. Today we're joined by our guest, Shane Wood, our current WPA, or Writing Program Administrator, here at UCF. He is the host of Pedagogue, a podcast about teachers talking writing, featuring established and emerging scholars in rhetoric and composition. Dr. Wood's podcast, Pedagogue, won the 2021 Kairos John Lovis Award, along with the Computers and Composition Outstanding Digital Production Award in 2019. Dr. Wood is also the author of Teachers Talking Writing, Perspectives on Place, Pedagogies, and Programs, published in 2023. He has authored and co-authored more than a dozen articles and book chapters. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It is rare that we have, actually, this might be the first time, you might be our first, another professor who has a podcast. What led you to reach into that medium in our field?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't really know anything about podcasting whenever I started. Here's a story. So I was on my way to a wedding. My wife's brother was getting married in Texas. And we were driving and we were listening to a podcast. I think it was This American Life. And I really like that podcast
classic.
A lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And while we were driving, I kind of just looked over at Mel, my wife, and said, do you think I could like do a podcast where I just talk with teachers about their teaching? And I tend to be like overly ambitious and setting a goal. And so I said that knowing I didn't know anything about podcasting or editing or audio engineering or anything like that. And she said, you know, well, you like talking to people and, you know, you're pretty relational. So she was like, sure, I bet you could. So really I took that conversation and that idea, and that's what started Pedagogue. It was 2019, and I remember sending out a tweet when it was still Twitter, and just kind of posed this question of like, would anyone be interested in a podcast that's connected to our field, where I just talk with different teachers, with the main goal it being across institutional context and across different positions. And the reason why I say for that to be the main goal is because I have felt that at times the field promotes and amplifies voices that often come from privileged positions like R1 universities that have the time and the energy to research and to publish in the field. So these are the voices that we hear the most in the field because of how our publishing journal system and structure is set up. So I wanted then to kind of resist that model of amplification of voices that we kind of hear over and over, right? I love that being a medium mm-hmm. of publication, but I think podcasting provided an opportunity for different voices to be heard in different institutional contexts and from different positions of teachers, right? From graduate students to non-tenure track to adjuncts to tenure track faculty. So I felt like that medium provided an opportunity to create a fuller picture and understanding of what we do in the writing classroom. So that's, I think, one of the kind of genre affordances of podcasting. And that's kind of the origin story of Pedagogue.
That's fantastic. And I love that similarly to it's typically a privileged group of voices that are amplified the most. I think there's a very specific delivery method typically or historically in terms of those messages. And it's a static delivery. It's not necessarily an informal conversation, but you know, if it's not a presentation at a conference, it's a written paper, or you know, if you're lucky enough to record a lecture or something of that nature, it's not interactive. It's not, I'm looking for the opposite of like pre-planned, but it's spontaneous. I love that about podcasting. And my personal favorites are the ones that are the most conversational. We strive to keep it from sounding like I had to hit these points. These are your questions. Prepare your answers in advance and allow it to be a little more organic of an experience. And I think that component as a whole has been missing from academic conversations for a very long time.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, I'll add to that too. I mean, podcasting, like you said, that conversational, relational nature of we're sitting in a room, we're just engaging in discussion, right? Mm-hmm. There's not this time of thinking and brainstorming and writing and rewriting and revising and sending off and then getting feedback and revising. Like, to me, this captures everyday communication. Mm-hmm. We're in the hallways of our offices. We're a part of our everyday lives, wherever we're interacting. And this is what happens. The conversation happens. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's spontaneous. And I think podcasting captures, at least for me, what I cannot do through the written text. And some people can do really well. And I'll tell you what that is. Through the written text, a lot of people can kind of create characters and voices, right? They see like dialogue on the page and they see character kind of development and they like produce a voice. I haven't ever really been able to do that, like as a reader or a scholar. Mm-hmm. Like I just see words and I read words. I know for some people, like they can't comprehend that's how I engage in a text, but it really is, right? But like visual modes or even orality, it actually captures voices. It captures dialects and regional differences. It captures to me the whole person, where the page just doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. Again, that's like my personal bias, but podcasting allows you to capture the whole person and who they are. So I think it's really neat then to listen to a writer or a teacher or a scholar and hear their voice, because it's way more nuanced than I think what traditional alphabetic text on a page does for at least me. I can't speak for everyone, but I can't capture the voices of our field just through a scholarly article. Mm-hmm. I can if I'm sitting down and talking to an individual in our field, a teacher, scholar, and it creates this different type of, as you say, interactivity and engagement that is more relational than my understanding of them on the page.
So when did you start to kind of see what was happening when you were, you know, you started the podcast, you started having these conversations? How did all of that kind of start to inform your work? You know, it started as an idea to sort of start these conversations across institutions and teachers and, you know, researchers and scholars and things like that. When did you start to see, oh, I see something happening here and I see it kind of affecting, you know, your own work and how you approach what it is that you want to do?
Yeah, I've shared this story in a couple of spaces. I feel like I'm jumping into the role of storytelling. Nice. But I feel like for me, the things that informed my work as a teacher were always conversations like in grad school with my fellow peers. They were with like my colleagues. We all shared an office, right? And they were just discussions about teaching and what was working and what wasn't working. And then what were you doing? And like this type of problem solving that happens again through conversation and not through text. So I've shared that I learned more through those conversations about teaching and the teaching of writing than I did in my graduate seminar classes. And it's not to say that those graduate seminar classes weren't important. I think they were. Theoretically, they gave me great foundational understandings of what the teaching and writing is. But in terms of the praxis of teaching and writing, in terms of like the exchanging of ideas and materials, that happened in conversations with my graduate student colleagues and my peers. So I think for me, that what podcasting, what Pedagogue allows me to do in terms of like that trajectory of career, it allows me to continue to have conversations that I had in grad school that at times I would say are absent in the field, because we graduate and then, okay, now we're teaching a 3-3 or a 4-4, and now we're just focusing on our teaching. And yeah, there might be some professional development spaces in a department that allows us to have conversations. But for me, this kind of like amplify that even more by saying like, hey, I can reach out to other teachers in different institutional contexts and learn about their teaching and learn about what they're doing. So I always tell people that I feel like I learn the most through the process, right? Like people engage in the podcast and hear the episode, but really they also only hear like 25 minutes, right? They don't hear any of the pre-recording conversation that happens. Mm-hmm. They don't hear the whole conversation because I kind of edit it to fit that format of podcasting. So I actually feel like the biggest student, like the biggest student in that interaction. And I also feel like I learn the most than even listeners do, because I've had all these interactions asking questions that don't get like heard, right? So I feel like I'm constantly in this role of student and teacher and kind of thinking through, okay, this teacher is in this institutional context. Like I just did a series on tribal colleges and universities, and I've taught at a tribal college and university, but it was really nice to hear what those practices look like in the writing classroom and then think through how might that inform what I do at the University of Central Florida? Like how does that change and shape the way that I see teaching and my understanding of teaching? Because we all have different pedagogies and practices. So I feel like I'm always in this position of learning and listening. I think that's the key thing. It's like, I'm just always listening to what other people are doing. And I would love to just be a student forever in the classroom. And the podcast allows me to do that.
I love that. And I appreciate the breadth of the fact that you're speaking across institutions. And I think that's been one of the fantastic things and one of the guiding forces for us to create our podcast was we get in our little tunnel vision moments where, you know, maybe we have a couple colleagues we talk to about the work we're doing or what we're seeing. But even departmentally, you know, you're not often in a room where you can talk to everybody and gauge what's happening in their classrooms or what are they finding that is working or not working. And just the fact that even the research that we're all doing is often, you know, only a specific few are aware of. So I love this idea that we can have these conversations and also see what is happening across different institutions in terms of our students. Are these phenomenon that are specific to us here at UCF? Are these things that are happening nationally? Are we seeing them only in certain demographics? So I love that ability to kind of open up the floodgates. You know, as academics, we're not necessarily the most, I always say we're kind of like these maladjusted people that, you know, we have like an area of expertise that we like and we kind of just like dig in. So we're not necessarily the people that are out like shouting from the mountaintop what it is that we're doing. And I like this chance that we can share that in an audience that is receptive and open and wants to know more and learn from the experiences that we're having in the classroom. But yeah.
Yeah. And I think too, it also makes public our work as teachers, mm-hmm. which I think is really, really important. And I think that's where like we might think through what is our responsibility in terms of our social responsibility, like what's our social and civic participation and responsibility outside the classroom. So I think this genre and format allows for our teaching and expertise and knowledge to extend well beyond the university. I think that's a huge benefit of, you know, uploading an MP3 to an RSS feed and it's circulating on Spotify or Apple or Google, wherever you listen to your podcast. But that information then reaches, it has the potential to reach a different audience. And I think about how kind of activist type work is always kind of thinking through in like academia, not just the academic space, but what's our relationship within our communities and beyond our communities, and how if we're not, if teachers are not the ones talking about our practices and talking about our students, who is talking about our students and practices?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm being honest, it's people not in the classroom, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's politicians, it's opinion pieces and newspapers, mm-hmm. like letter to the editors, and they're so separated and so disconnected from students in the classrooms. So this is why I think this type of work is important, because it moves beyond institutional facing to public facing. And I think we need to do more of that work. Like we really need to do more of that work. And if we don't, I think we'll see how others are placing their views and perspectives of the classroom and what we should be doing or what students should be doing. So I think now maybe more than ever, it's important for our voices to be heard and to be louder, mm-hmm. In public spaces, so that there is this idea and understanding of what happens in the writing classroom,
yeah.
or like what happens at the university, and how our students are feeling and experiencing the content and the practices that we're engaged in, and how meaningful it is, not just to this space, but to the public, to again, our local communities, because that's where our lives are lived.
Yeah.
Our lives are lived outside the walls of academia.
Yeah, I think I was just saying this to a colleague the other day, that as professors in the humanities, we've become the butt of a lot of social jokes. Like, we've become a punchline. Because I think that there isn't a lot of transparency as to what it is that we're bringing, the value and the experience of what we're doing to our students. And I love that we're like peeling back the veil a little bit and saying, no, yeah, this is not something to make fun of. Like, sure, we can all poke fun at ourselves, but if you have an actual understanding of what it is that we're doing, we're less likely to be the source of criticism and I'm trying to think of the word, like renovation. You know, if we're looking at overhauling the university system and no longer valuing things like humanities courses, that's a dangerous position to be in. But shifting gears a little bit, I was wondering if you would tell us a little bit about your previous experience and how that has informed your approach to coming into UCF.
Yeah, so as a kind of a writing program administrator
perspective. Yeah, and yeah, your approach towards composition, yeah.
Yeah, so the through line in my approach, I would say, elsewhere and here, is always like students, right? Mm-hmm. That's the foundation of everything I think that we do as teachers, or that we should do as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So my commitment to students and supporting and helping students is the same, right? The ways in which the first year writing classroom and program operates is very different based on the experiences, right? So I came from an English department, and this is a standalone department of writing and rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a university where the first year writing classes were mainly taught by graduate students. Here at UCF, it's mainly taught by full-time faculty. So just, I would say, really big differences in the structure as a WPA of what that looks like from an independent writing program to connected to an English department, from who's teaching the classes. So from a curriculum standpoint at my previous institution, things needed to be a lot more cohesive and centralized, right? So I say that not in the sense of things aren't cohesive and centralized. I'm saying the ways in which curriculum was taught was like, here's your sequence of assignments, right? Here's a common text. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're doing because we have to do this. You're an incoming MA, PhD student. You're teaching for the very first time this semester.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing to really grab onto, mm-hmm. right? And your PhD or MA is in literature and creative writing and not rhetoric and composition. So there's not even like a disciplinary history unless you come from a program like an MA that has that, mm-hmm. That experience. Here, these are really smart, intelligent teachers who have been teaching for a really long time, who have disciplinary history in rhetoric and composition, who understand pedagogies and practices in our field. And then also within our apartment, this rich history of writing about writing curriculum, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that there's just a lot of differences in what the program looks like, right? So I think for me this year, as my first year, I guess I'm 8 months, 9 months in, was like just sitting back and understanding these really big institutional differences. Mm-hmm. And I think just listening and learning more about what our really smart faculty are doing in the classes, right? And how, you know, I would say in our program, there's student learning outcomes and e-portfolios, and that informs and guides everything. So we might be assigning different text, though all of it's connected to writing studies. In writing studies scholarship, the kind of foundation and through line of our first year composition classes are the student learning outcomes in ENC 1101, student learning outcomes in ENC 1102, which I'll say is really cool because it was kind of grassroots and communal of how those student learning outcomes came to be. To me, you know, it wasn't top down. It was like collaborative and faculty collaborating and working on
these students. Yeah, I think, were we both on that, the outcome revision committee?
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So we were involved in that. It was intensive.
So I love the collaboration and participation that happens within composition here at UCF. There's this investment in first year writing and helping support our students. That is just really phenomenal as a WPA. That it's almost like it's a part of the culture. That investment is a part of the culture to do like really cool grassroots thing, like developing student learning outcomes for our two classes, working on this semester and last semester, working on program assessment rubric together collaboratively to then assess the student learning outcomes to see how they're working or how students are demonstrating that. So yeah, this commitment and investment that's just built in the culture here is really amazing. And yeah, just I said this a lot, but just the incredibly talented faculty that's teaching for sure writing here.
You can keep saying it. That's fine.
Okay, yeah. I'll say it like seven more times. I'll make a note.
Maybe make a plaque we can hang on the wall. That'd be fine.
I was going to ask, you know, what sort of, you know, first drew you to writing program and administration as a focus for you? What were those experiences like where you were like, oh, this is where I want to go, or this is what I want to sort of invest in. This is what I want to be about and go for. Do you remember, like, you know, what those were or how that sort of path, how you found that path?
Yeah, I think I fell into it. It wasn't like pre-planned. I wasn't like a graduate student. I was like, here's my research emphasis is going to be in writing program administration. As a graduate student, like my main focus was on writing assessment and teacher response and multimodality. Like those were the things that was my interest. That was like my work. And even whenever I got hired at my previous university, it wasn't in like this WPA capacity or this role. I was able to see modeled to me a phenomenal WPA at my previous university, Dr. Joyce Inman, just a phenomenal like leader. And she was in a kind of a point of transitioning outside of that role. So that provided an opportunity to step into writing program administration. And I don't know if I would have been drawn to that without seeing like her leadership and seeing that modeled to me so well and so gracefully. So really I would say it wasn't in grad school, even though I did serve as like the assistant to the director, like assistant to the regional manager.
Exactly.
Like I was like the assistant to the writing program director. So I had an experience there. But it wasn't like the type of like mentorship role that a WPA takes or the type of professional development role or curriculum development role or program assessment role. All of that wasn't really my experience in grad school. I think I was mainly just interacting with textbook publishers who would come in. So then at my previous university, when that opportunity opened up and whenever Joyce transitioned away from that role, then there was a lot of these experiences with, okay, program assessment and curriculum development and professional development and mentoring graduate students. And that was a big part of my previous institution, was that mentorship of graduate students, because those were the students teaching our first year composition classes, and then also teaching like our graduate practicum and composition theory that kind of tied pedagogy to praxis. So yeah, that kind of came through a leadership shift and change, but it wasn't on my radar. It wasn't necessarily something I was seeking out. And I think for some WPAs, that might just be like the normal story, right? Like we just find ourselves in this position of there's a gap, and that is a central role in composition. Like you have to have a WPA, you know, like that. It's essential in order for it to run well, and for there to be like a culture of like collaboration and curriculum development and again professional development and assessment. Like that is such a vital role. And I think I just kind of stumbled upon it, and then I saw just a great model in Joyce and how she did that work.
And I think there's also a really kind of natural connection between your focus also on assessment. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I know that you've mentioned in department meetings your enthusiasm and passion.
Very, very enthusiastic about assessment.
Yeah.
Everyone is. Everyone loves assessment. I'm just kidding.
Sure.
Most people are. Not really.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of, you know, how those two kind of go together, you know, the WPA and, you know, the assessment part, and just... Where does the enthusiasm for assessment come from?
Well, I think I'm going to share a story again.
We're here for stories, Shane.
Yeah.
So honestly, that enthusiasm comes from my MA thesis chair, Asau. Asau is in writing assessment, and you know that was like back in 2012 to 2014. But he was my thesis chair and mentor, and he's done incredible work on writing assessment. Him and Maya Poe wrote, like in 2012, Race and Writing Assessment. So really started connecting kind of justice-oriented frameworks to writing assessment and how do we assess students as a language? What are we valuing, right? Like how do we resist this notion of a standardized English, and how is that hurting or harming students? So I think that enthusiasm was probably, again, modeled to me because he was and is very passionate about writing assessment and very passionate about his work in writing assessment. So it started then probably, right? Like thinking through, okay, I'm working alongside and being mentored by someone that is incredibly passionate about writing assessment. And I remember taking a class from him as a grad student, and what was really interesting is that this class was focused on teacher response. And I think that's what captivated me more than writing assessment. So like in terms of writing assessment, I'm thinking particularly like this focus on like grading and classroom ecologies of grading and how that takes different shapes from like traditional grading to grading contracts and now popularized like ungrading, like just different alternative methods for grading. But I was more interested in responding to student writing. So I would remember reading in that class like Summers and Straub and Anson and all these scholars and O'Neill and Fife, all these scholars doing work like in the 80s, in the 90s on teacher response. And I'm still to this day like, where is current scholarship on teacher response to student writing? It exists. There's a Journal of Response, and they do incredible work. But like in the 80s and 90s, it felt very, very like captivating. Like the way that we interact with students come through how we respond to them.
Like there's that's more of a sense of
that's
urgency.
That's the relationality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that is the relationality, and that's how we teach writing. At least that's how it was framed. Is like you can talk about writing, but then the teaching of writing actually happens when students are writing and you're responding and interacting with them. That's the teaching of writing. So I was captivated by the power of response and how it can encourage or it can really hurt, right? That very affective component. Like we can all probably share stories of or memories of when we receive feedback and we felt kind of devastated, mm-hmm. like, or we felt like not good enough. Mm-hmm. And my thesis actually kind of started with that narrative of like feeling like not good enough because of response. So the story, I'll come back to what you said. The story was that enthusiasm, I think, was a model for me for writing assessment. I went in the direction of teacher response as an MA in my thesis. I continued that direction in my dissertation, focusing on genres of response and how students felt and interacted with particular comments. So I did, survey data and interview data analyses of that, asking questions of like that affective component of response. From a WPA perspective, and I think this goes back to your question, is what does assessment do? Well, to me, it does everything, right? Like how we understand our students, how we understand our curriculum, how we understand our program vision or outcomes, how we understand professional development and what opportunities to provide instructors, how we understand mentoring and one-on-one relationships with students. Like that, to me, it all starts with assessment. And I know some people might think, well, it could probably start elsewhere. And I think it can, right? But I think, again, this year is like thinking through, we have these amazing like student learning outcomes that were like grassroots, faculty-led, developed. As a WPA, then my perspective is how do we know how those student learning outcomes are being met or demonstrated, or how are they being centered in our writing classrooms? And I think you can't answer that question without talking about assessment, right? Like, and kind of data-driven assessment, not just anecdotally. Like, I think stories about that's great, but I think that there has to be some like direct measurement of outcomes and vision, and that is the work of assessment. And that's why I'm so enthusiastic about assessment, because I think it really, that's the beginning of anything else. Like, we don't just make changes to make changes, right? Mm-hmm. Like that makes no sense to me, right? Like we don't just like change things. And especially if you're a new person, like you don't just come in and like just change everything, right? Like that would not be a good idea.
Well, you that's could, like, but yeah, I don't know how that would work.
Bad idea. Like you use assessment to kind of inform decision-making, and ultimately decision-making is connected to student success. Mm. But that is assessment work.
I can almost see that anecdotal assessment or anecdotal feedback could be a step towards data driven. Like it might be the aha, like eyebrow raising moment where you start to go, is this a one-off or an outlier phenomenon? Or is this something that we're seeing across a broader student demographic? But the challenge that I face is that when I hear the word assessment, I immediately assume deficit-oriented. And I don't think I'm alone. I mean, I could be. I could be entirely alone. That's not the first time I've had a thought all to myself. But I think that is a challenge rhetorically with that word, assessment. You think, okay, it's punitive. It's deficit-oriented. We're going to have to figure out what we need to fix, right? Let's assess the situation is what we usually say after a moment of catastrophe. Let's assess so we can figure out what we need to fix and move on. So I appreciate that your approach is founded in this idea of how can we lead towards more opportunities for impactful professional development and how can we better serve our students. But in general, is there something that you try to incorporate into your philosophy or to your approach that offsets that predisposition to think of it in a negative frame?
Yeah, I think you have to be really intentional in how you resist standard constructions of assessment, right? I think that story of assessment being negative by far the most popular understanding of assessment, right? Like that it's because assessment has been and always has been connected to penalizing students, right? Like that kind of deficit.
Or
yeah, mm-hmm. or faculty, mm-hmm. right? It has been some, you know, Asal's written about this in some point, but considered a yardstick model, right? So here's the yardstick. Let's measure someone's successes or failures, basically. And then the way we do that is we standardize things, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So you have to resist that standardization, that top-down assessment being used to penalize, assessment being used as a consequence, assessment being used to move you from here to here, and to think through, to challenge that standardization, right? And in the writing classroom, you have to think about this, how assessment is tied to writing and language and identity. Those are interconnected. Writing and identity are interconnected. When we're assessing students' writing, we're assessing their language and their identity. That, of course, is going to have even more weight than here's a Scantron, like fill in the bubbles and I'll just put it through a machine. You know what I mean? Like the work that we do as writing teachers and writing assessment is kind of inherently connected to students' language and identity. So I think we have to be mindful of the systems and structures of how assessment has been used through this deficit-oriented framework to tell students or to instruct students about a standardized language, which is not true. That's not true at all. And then how assessment is being used as really a powerful tool to reinforce standardization and to penalize students, right? So I think as a teacher, then we have to be really mindful of that history. In my classroom, I talk with students, I engage in conversations about my understanding of assessment and how assessment has traditionally been used as gatekeeping, mm, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an exclusionary practice,
mm-hmm.
right? If we look at the history of the university, it's not hard to find what identities were privileged. So that's connected to assessment, right? That was assessment. Entrance exams were assessment. Who's allowed in, who's allowed out, whose voices are welcomed, whose voices are suppressed. So I talk with students about assessment through that lens. And then I talk about assessment, how I feel that it's important for me as a teacher to take a more justice-oriented approach to assessment. And by that, I really mean I want assessment to be focused on equity, right? I want students to have power and authority and control over assessment and not me. I want, you know, ideally they're not to be grades at all, but that's not an institutional reality. Like you do have to grade. So I want students to collaborate in all the assessment kind of processes, whether we're building rubrics, I don't bring in a rubric. We're building that together, right? And even then, I'm not just giving feedback. I want them to reflect on their learning based on that rubric that we co-constructed. And then I'll reflect on their writing process and their reflection of that writing process as it's related to the dimensions that we come up together. But I don't grade student writing. Actually, I use a grading contract, and that's not for everybody. I'm not saying that's for everybody, but I use a labor-based grading contract or construction of a labor-based grading contract that really emphasizes more quantity and focusing on like the writing process and the production of writing and not just like the final product of that writing and then assigning a letter grade. So it's been a while since I've put a grade on a piece of writing. The key to me is like that doesn't necessarily mean that students know where they stand in the class. And I think it's really important that there's that transparency, that students know where they stand.
Mm.
So there's a lot of conversation about like, let's reflect on where you are in this course based on the labor that you've produced, right? Because I don't want students to get up to the end of the semester being like, I have no idea. I don't know if mm-hmm. I'm going to get an A. I don't know if I'm going to get a C. And I think sometimes like that can happen in a grading contract, and it can cause anxiety, and I do not want to cause stress and anxiety. I just want to kind of always engage in transparent communication around assessment and grading.
It's an enormous paradigm shift for students. If you consider that their formative experiences as writers has been to produce something that will be assessed in a standardized way from very early on, I assign a literacy narrative in my 1101 courses, and it's, you know, what have your experiences with writing been up to this point? What has caused you to become the writer you are today? You know, what has shaped you? And at least half of them share stories about, I love to write until I had that one teacher. It's somewhere between sixth and eighth grade, typically, right? And I got all this feedback and criticism, and it just took the fun out of writing for me, and I've never enjoyed writing since. And so it is, you're dealing with students also in freshman composition on the precipice of just understanding the world in a very different way. You know, formatively, it's a whole new chapter for them as individuals. So it is a tremendous, not only are they learning about writing as writing, you know, writing about writing, that pedagogical approach where, you know, writing is the activity as well as the foundation of what we're studying. The idea that writing takes place in multitudes of ways every single day, and that they are all already strong writers or they wouldn't be here, to then add to that mix, like the idea that we're assessing and it's not punitive. It is a tremendous shift for students. So,
yeah, I think too, what's really important is I think having those conversations, and that's what I do. Like what you just modeled is what I do with students, right? Like I think through, hey, I have three little girls, a 6-year-old, 5-year-old, and 1-year-old. I don't have to convince them to love reading and writing and mm-hmm. drawing. They love reading and writing. I mean, they don't, you know, they're working on it, but they don't, it's not like a penalty. Like yeah. they love that curiosity, imagination, all the things that we had as kids, that are just like intrinsic. We just love that. So the conversations that I have with students is, when does that shift happen? When is that like creativity and that curiosity and like persistence? When does that change? And my conversations are always, well, it changes because of our educational system of assessment, right? To rank and sort students. It changes when, starting in kindergarten, you get a star or a sticker or your stick pulled. That was my experience. Like your stick pulled, right?
What?
Of like behavioral, like participation, you know,
stick
like you
pulled,
get a check mark.
To expand on
yeah,
this.
So
this is something I might want to bring into my classroom. Why I'm asking.
Cause. So in Kentucky growing up, like kindergarten, I think first grade, there was like a little pocket on your lockers
mm-hmm.
and it had like little sticks, like little, like just like wood sticks, like popsicle sticks.
Okay.
And it would be pulled. Like if there was like a behavioral issue or
like a
problem.
Flag.
So
okay.
you would lose. Yeah, okay. you would lose. So I share that story to basically say, maybe we should go back to that. No, I'm just kidding. So we have these conversations about our educational system, how grading and assessments baked into it and how it's baked into it in really detrimental ways to learning that don't foster creativity or curiosity or imagination or responsibility. Like it just doesn't foster those things. So there's this great book by a psychologist named Alfie Cohn. I remember reading it. I think it was in 1999. It's a book called Punished by Rewards. And that it's the critique of the educational system. So how even rewards are this extrinsic motivators, and that's what grades are. They're seen either as a penalty or as a reward, right? Like mm-hmm. you get an A, that's a reward. If you get a C or a D, F, that's a penalty. I need to get away from an F, right? Like that's failure. Failure is not good. It's mm-hmm. negative. It's negative. Like, and that's the stories that we get told from 6 years old mm-hmm. to forever, mm-hmm. right? Until there's a paradigm shift where you're faced with a different model. And particularly in relation to educational psychology, that research shows that we should care about intrinsic motivation, right? not extrinsic motivators. And extrinsic motivators actually do the opposite of what we want to do in our classrooms. We don't want, like, here's a carrot, like, follow the carrot. We want students to have, like, this sense of agency and ownership and creativity, and we want to foster that and not punish and reward students by these extrinsic things that really don't really matter. And then they don't tell us much about learning, right? So I share stories all the time. Like, first week of class, I'm like, hey, show of hands if you've gotten an A on a test and, like, haven't learned anything. Or you've gotten an A in a class and you haven't learned anything. They're like, oh, yeah, like, all the hands go up. And I'm like, okay, and show of hands if you've, like, studied really hard for weeks and weeks on a test and then gotten, like, a C or a D. Like, and everyone's hands go up. And I'm like, what does that say about learning? What does that say about how we value learning if we can get an A on a test, not learn anything, or an A in a class, not learn anything, and we are more satisfied about that A than the learning?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's problematic. To me, that's the opposite of education. And I just tell them kind of straight up, I don't know why we're here if that's the model that we're after. Like, this system doesn't make sense if we care more about you getting an A in a class and you feeling more satisfied about the A than the C. And there's a total separation from learning. Like, that, if learning isn't what's valued, I don't know what we're doing. I don't know why education exists. I know that might be extreme, but no, it's for real.
You raise a really interesting point that I'm thinking about, in that when you go into academia, as professionals, it's because you typically really love something. You love teaching other people about it. You believe in the value of it. But we were also the students who got the A's. You know, I tell this to my to grads. No, well,
not me.
Eventually, so I struggled sometimes too. But eventually, I think you reach that point where you're like, yeah, I want to be at the top of the class. And I talk to students about this a lot. Like, the shift from being an undergrad to a grad student is, a lot of the time, you're used to being the smartest person in the room, or at least one of the three smartest people in the room. And then you go into grad school and it's everyone's the smartest person in the room, and you suddenly don't know where you are. I think that's where that kind of, like, imposter syndrome starts to creep in. But if we're, as faculty, you know, we're used to that carrot and stick. We've built a lot of our lives on living through semesters, you know. Okay, I live my life in weeks. We're in week 10. I know exactly what week of the semester it is at any given point. And it's a very different way to view the world and life. But I wonder, too, like, if that is where that negative foundational feeling about assessment as a faculty member comes in, that you can't help but feel that it's punitive because you want the A. You've always wanted the A. And it's a little terrifying to think you're going to get anything but. So I'm curious then, I know that your approach towards student perspectives on assessment is well-founded and thought through and executed. What do you then bring to faculty who, when they hear, for example, here at UCF, we collect our Composition 1 and 2 students' portfolios for programmatic assessment because we want to see how students are responding to the, as you phrased, grassroots formative or structural approach to teaching composition? How are students internalizing and processing and then producing things to that effect? It's a little unnerving when you hear a request for randomized student portfolios. So how do you couch those kinds of conversations with faculty to prevent it from having that punitive connotation for assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to my values of, like, just collaboration and transparency and open conversation and communication. I think it feels that way when it's not talked about, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think mm-hmm. assessment really feels that way when it's not shared what's going on, when there's no transparency, when there's no understanding of, like, the random sampling method that we use or the collection process that we use and why we use it. So I think you all know maybe more than a lot of people, is, like, I talk about program assessment a ton. I just try to make it open and honest and transparent, and this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. And I think a part of that process is that communication of, this program assessment is not connected to your teaching at all. Like it really isn't. It's measured, the direct measurement is of our student learning outcomes. So it has nothing to do with the students that we're grading, like that we're scoring, right? Students' grades aren't connected to program assessment, and a teacher's performance or evaluation isn't connected to program assessment. Program assessment is legitimately just tied to what are our goals as a program and how are we meeting those goals? What are we doing, right? Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it's that communication of like, you're not being assessed as a teacher. Students aren't, like your students not being graded or assessed. And I think there has to be that delinking of understanding of like, oh, yeah, this isn't about me or my student. It's about our program and our goals and our outcomes and our vision, right? So what we're looking at then is how are our outcomes being embodied in classrooms through ePortfolios, and then what can we as a program do from a curriculum standpoint or professional development standpoint to help us do the things that we value. So I think what's really nice is in a more collaborative culture that we have is that that collaboration took place not just in assessment, right, of like forming the rubric together, of norming together, of having conversations and so many conversations about each outcome and what language we want to use for the rubric. Like it's so collaborative, like it's a long process. So I think that's really important, but I think it's also really important for faculty, for that collaboration to happen even in the student learning outcomes as it happened here. So there's a sense of investment of the outcomes. Those outcomes aren't top down. So I'm more familiar with like a, it's called GEC, but GEP here, here's the outcomes, make sure you're meeting these institutional requirements. Mm-hmm. That's very different than grassroots collaborative program developed assessment outcomes that faculty wrote that we're like now collaborating on through assessment. Then here's the institutional outcomes. And that feels like, are you doing your job? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's a shared investment, I would say, in our outcomes and in our ePortfolio. So it just continues the collaboration and conversation around that work that's already happened historically here.
I want to ask, I know we're closing in on our time for this episode, but I did want to shift gears a little bit and ask you a couple questions about your book and how your book came together. You know, this book about conversations about teaching, you know, drawn from the Pedagogue podcast. And I'm just curious because I think that's such an interesting kind of project to take on. And I'm wondering, you know, in the course of doing all these things and having all these conversations, when did you start to see like a shape of a thing like a book or something like that where, you know, where you could sort of talk about and share like collectively, you know, again, because it there's, I'm not sure how many episodes in the 200s.
Yeah.
Lots of episodes, lots of conversations. Like, how does that even happen? How's the process of that like come to be? Like, oh, I think there's something here that I can look at all of these things in some kind of collective way.
Not because we're trying to steal your idea or anything.
No,
just
yeah,
to
go
be clear.
For it.
Oh, we'll put the we'll put the link in the bio so people can go and get a copy.
No, yeah, feel free to. So I think like any other, like all my stories so far, like it's brought to my attention. Like I think back to, you know, how Pedagogue started. Well, Mel just brought it to my attention.
Shout out to Mel. Yeah.
And then how the book got started was Steve Parks and Paula Matthew, who are teacher scholars in our field, brought it to my attention. And they were really good mentors for me. They were on the podcast, but they said, hey, where does this count in your department, like your evaluation? And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. Like, you know, I'm first gen, like academia, all that is like, all these things are like new to me. I'm like, I need to be paying attention to like program evaluations and like tenure promotion stuff, like promotion stuff. And they were like, yeah, you need to like really pay attention to this. Like you're spending a lot of time and energy, like writing interview questions, interviewing, recording, reading scholarship. So you're prepared to ask questions, tons of editing, producing, you have a website, you have social media, like circulating, like that's a lot of time and energy. And they were like, hey, I'm going to be honest. They were real honest. They were like, in most places, multimodal and digital work is not seen under the umbrella of research. And I was like, kind of like, I was like, what? Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, how is it not? And they were like, you need to ask questions. Like, you need to think through and ask questions. And it was seen as service. I'm like, well, I would rather write an article because it takes a lot less time than doing what I'm doing with podcasting. You know what I mean? Like an article, I think it takes a lot less time than a weekly podcast, you know? So I went back to them and they were like, you really need to think through, like, how can you take what you're already doing and make it something else so that you're not having to like reinvent the wheel, write a whole book, you know, like
work smarter, not harder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Steve was like, you should just make this a book. Like he was like, you shouldn't make this like a composition anthology of the teaching of writing. Like we all were kind of assigned in graduate practicum classes in composition. So here's a traditional anthology, but it's not like that. It like intervenes in a lot of ways where you're not hearing just one voice. Each chapter, there's four or five teacher scholars talking about either a place, a pedagogy, or a program. It's digital. So instead of just reading text, you can listen to scholars. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to our earlier conversation, there's a full understanding of the human behind the words. And there, again, regional differences in their dialects and the way that they're thinking in real time and not through, like, revision and this, like, lengthy process of editing and revising. And that's kind of how it came to be, is they brought that to my attention. And then that opened up, like, the opportunity for, a book proposal. And then I think there was just a perfect moment where... So Teachers Talking Writing is published through NCTE and CCCC, the SWR Studies in Writing and Rhetoric series. And there was a perfect opportunity where that series was starting to collaborate with WAC Clearinghouse, and WAC Clearinghouse is open access. This book doesn't exist unless it's open access. Everyone can listen to these episodes anytime they want. Mm. And I have transcripts. Mm-hmm. Like the material is already available. So I think it provided an opportunity where they were like, oh, we actually have this new initiative. And I think this was the first book published in that initiative. I think this came alongside one other book that was open access. And it only makes sense if it's open access, because in the book you can click the hyperlink that's timestamped so you can hear the conversation as opposed to just reading like the text. So I think, yeah, just really good mentorship that they provided of saying, like, think smarter.
Not harder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, like, what does this look like as a book form and not just as a podcast? So all credit to them. And, yeah, just I've been lucky with a lot of, like, great mentorship. And I think I just... like listen to people's advice and go with it usually.
Well, you've touched on something that I think is of significance twice. It's the value of hearing the delivery of ideas through the voice that is creating them. And I think if anything, it's an argument as to why AI won't replace us. Because if you've ever listened to a text read by AI, it's not particularly engaging or fun to listen to.
Yeah.
And I think to ignore the, not maybe idiosyncrasies, but the characteristics that shape a voice, the formative and foundational experiences that create a particular voice, and then considering what that brings to the text is something really of value. And I can see, you know, you were talking about how when you read maybe even fiction or something along those lines, you don't hear the voices. And, you know, there's an argument for why audiobooks are as of value to people and legitimate in terms of, you know, did you read it versus did you listen to it? It's really the same thing.
Yeah.
How in academia, to get away from that idea of the ivory tower and the fact that we're mm-hmm. so far removed, mm-hmm. where only reading written text kind of puts that distance between the reader and the writer, this idea of then listening to the organic voice that created the text and is expressing the ideas is really something of value. And I love that inclusion of in our field.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of my work tries to think through the privileges of like my own identity and positionality, but also how systems and structures empower and privilege and continue these separations of power and privilege. And I think the same thing can be said about traditional definitions of literacy. Traditional definitions of literacy have been operationalized to privilege people who can read and write. Education, like, is focused on that traditional definition of literacy because it, again, from an assessment perspective, allows you to rank and sort people by gender, race, socioeconomic status, right? Like, that's really what it is. Can you read and write? Well, what kind of writing are we talking about? Like, it all benefited a particular identity from a racial, gender, and socioeconomic perspective.
Yeah. It allows you to control the narrative as well as erase others.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's also very westernized writing, right? So I think one thing that you know, podcasting and listening does is it is more inclusive, and it maybe resists some traditional understandings or definitions of literacy, for example, to say, actually, no, there's lots of literacies. Mm-hmm. And literacies cannot just be defined by reading and writing. And if it's so, that's very exclusionary. And that's not inclusive. And if so, we're really disconnected from our students in the 21st century. If we're only connecting literacy, their literacies, to reading and writing, we are very disconnected from 21st century everyday life of our students, right? Who constantly engage in much more creative content visually, through audio, through videos, through images. And that's why, again, I'm like so drawn to multimodality, because it's like traditional writing instruction is so, to me, exclusionary, right? Like, just focusing on the alphabetic text, when you have the affordances of all these modalities, when our students' experiences and histories are so much more expansive than reading alphabetic text on a page, it's like, I don't know how you go to the classroom without thinking about multimodalities, multimodality and various literacies of our students. And yeah, again, that kind of storytelling, that orality and orality kind of resists some dominant Western structures and systems that are ultimately connected to literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So we are closing in on our time for this episode, but I'm just wondering, Shane, you know, is there anything that you know, want to add or talk about, or something that you're excited about that's on the horizon for you, a project or something that you might be working on that you want to mention or talk about?
Yeah, I think right now I'm just most excited about just the collaboration and assessment again. Just the collaboration that's happening in the department about around assessment and really thinking through the ways in which how we can help support students, right? And again, not punitive, not penalize students, not assessing teachers or grading students, but really the collaborative kind of equity focused, justice-oriented perspectives around assessment. So like, for example, I think looking at, and this is just like preliminary, but what's really interesting about assessment is I think most writing teachers here and elsewhere, I'm like thinking about the data in ENC 1101, most writing teachers here and elsewhere would think like, we value revision, and like our students do it well. Like we talk about revision all the time. They engage in drafting and peer review, and like revision is essential to our work in the writing classroom. But if we have data that says, hey, maybe it's not being demonstrated through at least our direct measurement of e-portfolios, what do we do, right? It kind of like meets, there's tension between here's an assumption that I have as a teacher that I have, that most people have, I would say, with reality of data. And then we're like, what do we do? And that's exciting work to me, because then like you get teachers in a conversation, like in a group, talking about like, what do we do with this? Like, so I think that work's exciting. Assessment work is exciting. And I know it's not for most, but I love the excitement and like the brainstorming and the problem solving that happens. That again is not punitive, but really is like grassroots and collaborative.
Well, thank you for participating in our contagious enthusiasm for the work we do here. I do believe
I love the work that you all do here. It's amazing.
I think it's
a great
fantastic
model.
And it's always fun to delve into those topics with people that are equally as passionate about them. So thank you for taking the time, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.